Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be on listen-only until the question-and-answer session of today's conference, at which time you may press star one to ask a question. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, please disconnect at this time. I'd now like to turn the meeting over to your host, Mr. Nathan Baugh. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, operator, and I want to welcome all of our participants. My name is Nathan Baugh, and I am the Director of Government Affairs for the National Association of Rural Health Clinics and the moderator for today's call. Today's topic is Emergency Preparedness and Non-Discrimination Rules. This is a series sponsored by HRSA's Federal Office of Rural Health Policy and is done in conjunction with the National Association of Rural Health Clinics. We're supported by a cooperative agreement, as you can see on your screen, and through the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy, which allows us to bring these calls free of charge. The purpose of the series is to provide REC staff with valuable technical assistance and REC-specific information. Today's call is our 76th in the series, which began in late 2004, and during that time, there have been over 20,000 combined participants on the REC national teleconference calls, now also being done as webinars. As you know, there's no charge to participate in the call series, and we encourage you to refer others who might benefit from this information to sign up to receive announcements regarding dates, topics, and speaker presentations at hrsa.gov/rural-health/policy/conference-calls/index. We have the link posted later in the slides. During the Q&A period, we request that callers please provide their name, city, and state location before asking their questions, or you can type your question in on the chat box, which we will pull up during the Q&A section. In the future, email questions to info@narec.org and put RECTA question in the subject line. All questions and answers will be posted on the Office of Rural Health Policy Conference Call Series website, which we also have the link to that later in the slides. So with the formalities out of the way, we're going to begin our webinar today on emergency preparedness rules and the non-discrimination rules. So we're going to start with emergency preparedness, and then we'll get to non-discrimination second. And that's my contact information. If anyone wants to follow up with a question or a call via email or phone, feel free to use that info. So I don't expect anyone to be able to read anything on this page. The point of this slide is just to show you where we were. Currently, if you were to get surveyed today, you would only have to follow those three little bullet points on the left. Starting November 15th of this year, you have to comply with all of that rules and regulations that I have listed on the right. So the only point I'm trying to make on this slide is that it's a lot more, right? What we're doing now is a lot less than what we have to do starting November 15th. And I'm going to go over everything that's in the new rules. So as I mentioned, the implementation date is November 15th. However, these rules have already been finalized. It's a little confusing because the rules were finalized on November 15th of 2016, but they're not being enforced until November 15th of this year. So that is an important note to make. The old regime, those three bullet points that I had listed, it just said to train staff in handling emergencies. We had to place exit signs in appropriate locations and you had to take other appropriate measures consistent with the conditions of the area where your rural health clinic was located. Now, that was the old regime. The new regime is a new entirely expanded section in the Code of Federal Regulations, and it's section 491.12. So if you want the full rules and regulations, it's 491.12. And there's 491.12 A, B, C, D, and E. And we're going to go through each letter subsection slide by slide. 4912A, which is the first part, is effectively your emergency preparedness plan. The emergency preparedness plan must be created and updated every year. So if you don't have a plan, you have to create one. Now, it's a bit vague, but CMS purposely designed it that way. They're giving RECs kind of latitude to design how exactly this plan can be put together. There's a few key things that the plan must do, though. It has to have a strategy to address all the various emergency events that your clinic is at risk for. So if you're in the plain states, that includes tornadoes, maybe not hurricanes if you don't get hurricanes, maybe not earthquakes if your area gets earthquakes, but you want to think, okay, fire, is my clinic at risk for a fire? Is my clinic at risk for X, Y, or Z natural disaster? And you have to have a plan to address each specific event. These events also include things like an epidemic, a disease epidemic, or even an active shooter in your area or some sort of terrorist event. You have to analyze in the plan, you have to analyze your capability to help during the emergency, and you have to have an authority succession. So similar to how we have a line of authority, if the president dies, vice president becomes president. Vice president dies, speaker of the house becomes president. You have to have a similar delegation of authority and succession plan for your rural health clinic during an emergency. The other thing it has to have in your plan is a process to cooperate with the broader community on emergency preparedness. And if some of this gets repetitive, it's because the rules are a little bit repetitive, and it kind of elaborates on what that means to cooperate with the broader community on emergency preparedness in later subsections. And I will say one thing. Pretty much everything else about your plan, so all the other subsections that it'll ask you to do certain things, all of that goes into one plan. You don't have to have a separate document for each of these subsections. Everything can be folded up into one emergency preparedness plan, which is something they clarified in one of the FAQs. And before I go any further, I'm going to point out that the CMS has not yet released the interpretive guidelines for emergency preparedness. So some of the vagueness is designed to provide flexibility, and some things we might need further clarification on that we'll get in the interpretive guidelines that are supposed to be released before the summer. So we'll definitely keep everyone informed of those changes on the listserv, but it's something to look forward to really kind of getting those refinements as to if something means X, Y, or Z. All right, so the second part here, 49112B, is policies and procedures. Now, you have to have a policy and procedure, and this can be a part of your emergency preparedness plan, and you have to review them and update them annually. So when you have a surveyor come and they are asking for your policies and procedures, you have to show them that you've reviewed them and you've updated them within the last year. Similar to the old regime, you have to have exit signs, but now you also have to have an evacuation policy, and you have to have staff responsibility during that evacuation, okay? And I'll get into staff training later, but the staff really needs to understand what their role is during an evacuation. Furthermore, you have to have a means to shelter in place. I'm assuming most rural health clinics have that, especially if they're in a tornado risk area, but you have to have a means to shelter in place in case you cannot escape the rural health clinic. You also have to have a system of medical documentation that preserves patient info. So I got a question about this once. Someone asked me, I said, well, we keep all our medical documentation in a file cabinet. And I asked her, well, if your clinic were to, you know, burn down, would you be able to preserve that patient info? And she said, no. Clearly, that would not work for these rules. Now, someone then asked, well, what if it's a fireproof file cabinet? Would that qualify? And I'm not sure that's something that I would look for the interpretive guidelines to, but I think most rural health clinics will satisfy this requirement via backing up to the cloud or backing their information up to a server or having some sort of system that if it's a fire, a tornado, a hurricane, they're not going to lose all their patient records. Another thing that must be in your policies and procedures is how you will use volunteers to address surge needs. Now, the thing that I've thought of is how you could use volunteers is something like if you have rubble blocking your entrance or blocking access to parts of your building, you could use volunteers to help clear the area. You might also use volunteers to donate blood, things like that. All right, 49112C is the communication plan. Again, this is not a separate plan. This can be a part of your emergency preparedness plan. It also must be updated annually. It has to include contact info for all your staff, any contractors you have, your patients' physicians, other rural health clinics and FQHCs, volunteers, as well as all government emergency preparedness staff. So they have to have at least phone numbers and other contact information for those individuals. You have to have a primary and an alternate means of communication with RHC staff and governmental agencies. Now, this is something that, again, I'm looking for the interpretive guidelines to clarify. I know that, for example, like your primary means of communication can be like a cell phone, cell network. I know that some rural health clinics have satisfied the alternate means of communication requirement through some sort of radio or something like that. I don't know if you would consider over the internet a separate means of communication as opposed to like a cell service. So this is something that I'm looking towards CMS to clarify exactly what they mean by the alternate means of communication. If you have AT&T and Verizon, since that's two different networks, would that qualify? I'm not sure. Or do you need like a satellite phone or something like that? A way to provide, the other thing that your communication plan must do is you have to have a way to provide info about the condition of your rural health clinic and the location of your patients. So, for example, if you were to evacuate, you would obviously need to inform the government emergency preparedness staff where you located or where you evacuated your patients to in an emergency, or if they are sheltering in place, you would need to know where within the clinic the patients and your staff were sheltering in place. You also need to have a way to communicate to authorities about the ability of your RHC to provide assistance. So basically just have a way to assess, okay, our rural health clinic is up and functioning. We can take patients. We can assist in these ways. You just have to be able to communicate that to the government emergency preparedness authorities in your area. Training and testing. So this is probably the most burdensome or most difficult part of the new rules to comply with. Rural health clinics are required to train all staff and contractors consistent with their expected roles. And this is one of the things they clarified in the CMS call on emergency preparedness last week. Surveyors will ask your staff what their roles are during an evacuation, what their roles are during an emergency. And your staff needs to be generally competent on what their job is to do in an evacuation or any sort of emergency scenario. So that's going to be something that you really got to make sure that your staff knows what they're supposed to do, knows how they're supposed to evacuate, et cetera. You have to have one documented training a year for all staff. And, again, the staff must demonstrate understanding of the emergency procedure. So this is something that the CMS has said that they're going to come out with resources to help you train your staff. It will be, I think, a webinar. So they're going to be coming out with resources in hopefully a few months that will help you train your staff, but those are not yet fully developed. The rural health clinics also must participate in one full-scale community-based exercise annually. And you can check your state HHS website for more info. I have a link to that later where you can find what the emergency preparedness kind of local group is for you. They should all be listed on your state HHS website. In addition to the first full-scale community-based exercise, you have to have a second full-scale exercise or a tabletop exercise every year. So you can do two full-scale community-based exercises or one full-scale community-based exercise and one tabletop exercise. RHCs, you have to document that you did these drills, and you have to analyze your performance during the tabletop exercise, during the community-based exercise. A lot of people are aware what full-scale community-based exercise is. At least when I have spoke on this topic before, people seem to know what it was. Similarly, they seem to know what a tabletop exercise was. There's no sort of training that needs to be required for the person who's sort of walking everyone through the tabletop exercise. It can kind of be anyone. Again, you have to do two of those per year or one full-scale community-based and one tabletop exercise per year. These have to be done before November 15th. So even though these rules are not being enforced today, on November 16th, if a surveyor shows up at your rural health clinic, they're going to expect that in the last year, you've done those drills. So if you haven't done two community-based exercises, you know, this past year, then you need to get on that before November 15th. So that is something that they clarified as well in last week's webinar. And so I get a lot of questions about this as well. I know a lot of rural health clinics are part of a larger integrated healthcare system. And it is absolutely true that if you are part of a larger healthcare system, you can participate in that system's coordinated emergency preparedness program, but you need to make sure it does the following thing. One is that it demonstrates that each separate facility actively participated in the program. So, for example, let's say you are in a network of five other rural health clinics and you have maybe one or two CAHs, critical access hospitals. If one of those facilities didn't participate in the drills and the larger emergency preparedness program, then everyone in that healthcare system is out of compliance. So you're really trusting the entire healthcare system, every single entity to, you know, be responsible and make sure that they're compliant. You also need to make sure that the integrated healthcare system plan has taken into account each facility's unique circumstances. In my view, this means that you can't just have a policy for the cause or the hospitals and then a one other policy for all rural health clinics. I interpret that to mean that each individual rural health clinic has to take into account some sort of unique circumstance about that rural health clinic for it to meet these requirements. And as I said here, each separate facility must be in compliance. If one facility is out of compliance, I believe the entire healthcare system is out of compliance. So that is kind of my abbreviated version of the rules and regulations. Again, all of this is 49112, Code of Federal Regulations 491.12. If you Google it, you'll see pretty much exactly what I just laid out. I have a bunch of links here for more information. This first email here, scgemergencyprep@cms.hhs.gov, that was the email that they gave out last week in their webinar. Stands for Survey and Certification Group, Emergency Prep. If you have questions, you can email them. This second link is a really good link that I've used. It has a bunch of FAQs. I think there's 5 FAQs that go over all sorts of various questions that people have had about emergency preparedness. I believe the interpretive guidance, when it gets finalized, will also be posted at this link. And I mentioned the state healthcare coalitions that you have to coordinate your community-based exercise with. Though there's a link to all the various healthcare coalitions at the link here as well. And then the ASPR-TRACY link is also a great resource for healthcare providers. It stands for Assistant Secretary for Preparedness, Response, Technical Resources, Assistance Center, and Information Exchange, ASPR-TRACY. I believe when the training comes out that CMS is developing on how to train your staff and also training for surveyors will be posted at the ASPR-TRACY website. All right, so I'm going to move on to non-discrimination rules, and if people have questions about emergency preparedness, we'll have time at the end to answer those. So the non-discrimination rules were actually a part of the Affordable Care Act, and it was Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act. And it effectively said that rural health clinics are not allowed to discriminate on basis of race, color, national origin, sex, age, or disability and activities. That's, you know, kind of a standard non-discrimination policy that applies to all businesses. However, it did a couple of extra things that are sort of new for rural health clinics and for healthcare. We already had the requirement, I believe, to provide services, language services and sign language services free of charge to individuals with disabilities or individuals that don't speak English. Now, these services were already free of charge. Now, however, they have a lot more requirements of kind of these taglines, and I'll get into that in a second. I do want to make the point here, though, that covered entities, aka rural health clinics, we are a covered entity. If you have more than 15 employees, you have a few extra requirements to comply with on non-discrimination. You have to have kind of a point person, one employee responsible for kind of overseeing the non-discrimination policies, and you have to have some sort of grievance procedures that allow for prompt resolution of any sort of discrimination violation. I will note that rural health clinics must have, in multiple languages, a notice informing the individual of the non-discrimination rule, including how to file a complaint. So it's a bit of an awkward situation, but if someone wanted to file a complaint against your rural health clinic for discriminating, you would need to have a notice informing them how they might be able to file that complaint in their native language. And you don't have to have those posted, but you have to have those available. So, again, in reality, in my mind, it's a kind of an awkward situation. I guess the patient would be demanding that you give them documentation that will allow them to then file a complaint against you, but you must have those notices on hand. The bottom two links here are really good links for this. You have the first one is the general link that it links to the final rule, and it links to some FAQs. And the second link there is where you can get all your translations. They've translated everything that you've needed translated in every single language that you've needed translated into. They have all of that those resources at that second link. Okay. So, the non-discrimination taglines. Effectively, the phrase is language assistance services are available free of charge. That's what it is in English. You have to have that tagline posted in the top 15 languages in your state for all communications that you deem significant and not small. So you basically, any communication that you have, you have to do two things. One, you have to decide, is this significant? Two, you have to decide, is this small or is this not small sized? Right? If it's significant and it's also not small, then you have to post these taglines in the top 15 languages. So I have some examples here, and I pulled these from the link that I gave you in the last slide. I have Spanish, we have Chinese, I believe the next one is Russian, and I have French and Arabic. That's just some examples. So, as I mentioned, top 15 languages, you have to post those taglines. It has to be significant and anything that is not small. You also have to have those taglines posted in a conspicuous physical location. So I think for most of us, that translates into your lobby. So if you don't have that tagline posted in the top 15 languages in your state right now in your lobby, you need to go do that. And as soon as this webinar is over, go find the top 15 languages in your state and go post that tagline. Now, I know there's a lot of questions out there. Well, what is considered significant? And this is verbatim from the CMS answer in the CMS FAQ. Covered entities, aka rural health clinics, are in the best position to determine within reason which of their communications and publications are significant in the context of their own health programs and activities. So it is a bit vague, but they're basically leaving it up to you, the rural health clinic, to determine what is significant and what publications are not significant, although they do give some examples of things that they would consider not significant later, and I have those. So the last place I spoke about this was Iowa, and so this is my example, but they have the top 15 languages online for every single state, so you don't have to guess or do some research. For every single state, they list the top 15 foreign languages, and it's a list that looks something like this, right? And they even estimate the number of foreign speakers in each state. Furthermore, so you have the top 15 rules. You also have top two language rules. So this one, remember I said everything you send out, you have to do two things. Is it significant? Is it small? If it's significant, but it's small, then you have to post the tagline in the top two languages, and the top two foreign languages in your state, right? Furthermore, if it's significant and large, then you have to post a longer non-discrimination statement. So it's more than just we offer free language services. It's a longer statement, which I have next. So the statement is, name of your rural health clinic complies with applicable federal civil rights laws, does not discriminate on basis of race, color, national origin, age, disability, or sex. Okay, so again, this is the top two foreign languages in your state. If it's a significant publication, that full statement in the top two foreign languages needs to go on that publication. Again, you can find the translations on that link that I had a few slides back. I have the link to the FAQ, which has a lot of great information right there. I pulled out two of the questions that I think are relevant and that I think are informative. Like I said, here are some examples of things that CMS would consider not significant, so you wouldn't have to put any of the language stuff on these. Radio or television ads, ID cards, see those are really small, appointment cards, business cards, banners, envelopes, and outdoor advertising. So those are things that you definitely don't have to worry about putting any sort of taglines or foreign languages statements on. Some examples of things that are considered small size is be postcards, trifold brochures, and pamphlets. So remember, if it's significant but small, then you have to post the taglines in the top two foreign languages. So it's probably Spanish in most states, and at least in the example I gave of Iowa, it would be Chinese. So Spanish and Chinese, even on things that are considered small, such as postcards, trifold brochures, pamphlets, etc. Notably, they say that anything that's on an 8.5 by 11 inch piece of paper, so basically computer paper, that is not considered small size. So if you only have top two taglines on something that's on computer paper, that would not, you would be out of compliance with these rules. All right, and so of course I would be remiss to go over all these new rules and not talk about a few executive orders that may or may not apply. On his first day in office, President Trump issued a presidential memorandum basically suspending all pending regulation until someone from the Trump team could basically approve of it. So the first thing that popped into my mind when I read that executive order was, does it affect emergency preparedness rules? Because they're finalized in November, but they're not yet being implemented until November 2017. So does that make that regulation pending? We've asked for clarification. All signs indicate that this is not something that was affected by this presidential memorandum, even though seemingly it is. There's two other executive orders that I'm going to talk about before we get to the questions. The first was an order that was supposed to minimize the burden of the Affordable Care Act, and I quoted the relevant section here. It basically directs all the department heads to use all the authority and discretion available to them to waive, defer, grant exemptions from, or delay the implementation of any provision of the Affordable Care Act that would impose a fiscal burden on a state, et cetera, and then you'll see healthcare providers. It's one of the entities that if a rule imposes a fiscal burden on a healthcare provider, the department heads are supposed to find a way to grant exceptions or delay the implementations of that provision. So seemingly, because the non-discrimination rules, I remember I told you the language rules, that's part of Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act, and I think it quite clearly imposes a fiscal burden on healthcare providers, such as rural health clinics. Seemingly, this falls into that category, but I wouldn't bank on Secretary Price or even Administrator Verma changing these. These are already in effect. So you need to make sure you start posting those taglines immediately. And if it goes away, this might be how it would go away. Again, it's unclear. And then the final one here is an executive order on reducing regulation and controlling regulatory costs. Effectively, the executive order says for every new regulation, you must identify two regulations to be eliminated, and the cost of all the new regulatory items for fiscal year 2017 must be zero. So in the final rule, the government itself estimated that compliance for, or the cost of compliance for RHC is just over $6,000 per RHC per year, right? So we, as in the National Association of Rural Health Clinics, sent a letter to Secretary Price and Administrator Verma, as well as the staff over at CMS responsible for the emergency preparedness stuff, basically saying that, one, that we don't believe that these new emergency preparedness rules are necessary, and that they pose too much of a burden, especially on independent rural health clinics who can't just take, you know, spend $6,000 every year to comply with these rules. But two, we also asked for clarification, since that it's unclear whether or not this last presidential memorandum that I just went over, if that applies. And then finally, we said, if you do go forward with this new emergency preparedness rule, we expect that you find, in the spirit of this reducing regulation executive order, we expect that you find $6,000 worth of regulatory relief for rural health clinics. So that's effectively what the letter said. If anyone has ideas of things that rules and regulations that could be eliminated that would save rural health clinics money in terms of compliance costs, please send those ideas to NARHC so we can kind of hand those on a silver platter to HHS, because they're going to be needing to find, in order to comply with this executive order, a lot of cost regulatory relief. So that, again, all of this is pending. Do not bank on CMS saying, you know what, we can't find $6,000 worth of offsets, so we're just not going to go forward with the emergency preparedness rules. Act like they're going to, the new rules are going to take effect on November 15th of this year. But we are working to either, A, hopefully eliminate rural health clinics from the list of entities that have to follow this, or B, at least find some sort of other regulatory relief, considering that it's going to cost us $6,000 per RHC per year to comply. So with that, I'm going to close by just going over our listservs. For those of you who are not aware, we have two free listservs. One is for technical assistance, which is emails, it's RHC-specific info, one-way communication from NARHC out to everyone on that listserv. The other one is a two-way communication, which obviously means more emails, but clinics can ask each other questions, and, the peer-to-peer aspect is actually really nice. That's our news listserv. You can sign up for both or either at the link above. And then to view all our webinars, both this one will be posted on, at a later time on the link at the bottom, but you can also review every other webinar that we've done since the inception of this program, every other webinar since we started doing webinars at the link at the bottom. So with that, operator, I think we're going to move to our questions section. And the chat box is, I'll be monitoring the chat box now as well, so I know a lot of people like to ask questions that way. But I'm going to start with a question that was emailed from Kara Jo Carson, who is in Pinckneyville, Illinois. And she asks, will our hospital emergency operation plan and continuity of operation plan cover the RHC, which is hospital-based and department and a department located within the main hospital building? It probably will. I would just make sure you review the subsection, the integrated healthcare system requirements, right? So that goes, if you look at section E and you think that your hospital emergency operation plan fits with that, then you will probably, that will probably work for you. So hopefully I've answered your question. If not, always follow up via email. Operator, do you want to go over the instructions for how to ask a question?
Yes, thank you. We'll now begin the question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1. You'll be prompted to record your name. Please be sure to unmute your phone. Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1, and we'll pause for just a moment to allow those questions to start coming through.
Okay, so Lynn Hampson asked, do non-rural health clinics have to do this? I'm not sure what this is. I'm assuming she means the emergency preparedness rules. And the answer is, yes, there are a lot of other covered entities that have to comply with those emergency preparedness rules. However, a traditional doctor's office, a doctor's office that doesn't have to, a survey and certification process, would not have to comply with those emergency rules. It's one of the reasons one of our talking points to CMS is say, hey, a traditional doctor's office or a PA's office wouldn't have to have this emergency preparedness plan. So why do rural health clinics have to have one? Oh, just because you have a survey and certification process for rural health clinics, so you have a means of enforcing it. So it's one of the points that we're making to CMS. I'll do one more, and then we'll go to the phones. After looking at the top 15 languages, this is from Carrie, and we determined that there's only one other language that is significant in our area, then we only have to print the message in that one other language, correct? No, that is incorrect. I don't care if there are three people that speak that 15th language in your state. It does not matter. You have to have, it is state-based, and you have to have the top 15 languages, even if there are five people that speak that 15th language. So hopefully that's pretty crystal clear. Operator, do we have any calls over the phone?
Yes, we do have a question. This one comes from Lauren Harris. Your line is open.
Thank you.
Hi, Lauren. Where are you from?
Hi, we're from Sandy, Oregon.
Great.
My question is regarding the training and testing and the participation in community-based exercise. Is that a requirement
right.
of every employee and provider within the clinic, or can representatives be sent to do that?
No. My interpretation, if I'm understanding your question correctly, is that every single staff on your staff has to go through the training once a year.
Okay.
You can't have someone be like the emergency preparedness guy who knows everything.
Right.
Everyone's got to know or go through the training every year.
Okay. So if the community-based training happens, say, during a work day, you would essentially close down the entire clinic and send everyone to participate in the exercise?
I'm sorry. You said the staff training. I thought you were referring to the staff training.
No, I meant community-based emergency.
Yeah, you meant the drill. I'm honestly not that familiar with the community-based drills and what all they entail. I would assume that whoever is running the community-based drills kind of says, okay, we're going to need, I don't know if they need the full staff there or if they expect just a few members of the staff. I would defer those questions of how much of your staff have to go to that drill to the organizers of your community-based drill. But I'm actually not fully sure on that.
Thank you.
Yep. All right, so I'm going to go to the next question on the chat. It's from Leslie, and she says, I've been in and out trying to see a few patients during the webinar. I'm also looking for the copy of the PowerPoint. Oh, okay. Leslie, there's a bunch of different ways you can get the PowerPoint. One is on NAIHC.org, and Bill sent out the link if you're on the TA web listserv. Furthermore, if you look at the top left of your screen, there should be a box that says File Share. and you can download the PowerPoint there. So there's several different ways. They'll also be posted on a third website in a few weeks at the one I have listed here at the bottom. Okay. Operator, do we have any other calls?
We do not have any questions at this time. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1.
Okay, so I'm just going to power through some of the chat questions here. Shirley asks, when considering the languages, does English count? No. The short and the long answer is no. So it's the top two foreign languages, the top 15 foreign languages. English does not count. Okay, Jessica, I've already answered that question. Terry Miller, do actual emergency events, example, full-scale power outage, count toward the requirements for emergency preparedness activities? Terry, this is a great question, and the answer is actually yes. So if you are unfortunate enough to, you know, actually have to implement your emergency preparedness plan or initiate an emergency event, the silver lining is at least you do not have to do one of the community-based exercises. So that would count as your one of your community-based exercises for the year. So, of course, nobody wants to have to do, implement their emergency preparedness plan, but if you do, again, it counts as one of your drills. And that is something that they confirmed last week. Don Petty asks, we are a physician-owned small clinic, 12 employees. Do the non-discriminatory regulations affect us as well? Yes, Don, they do affect you. So hopefully you have those taglines posted on all your significant publications. I will say that there are some additional rules that clinics or entities with more than 15 employees have to follow. You don't have to follow those because you only have 12 employees. But the stuff about the taglines and the significant publications and the language services, all of that does still apply to you, even if you only have 12. Operator, do we have any calls on hold?
We do. We have a few waiting now. We have Liz Hansen from North Dakota. Your line is open.
Hello.
Hi, we just had a question about posting the taglines in a public place, like in our lobbies. We have TV screens where we have messages that keep scrolling through. Is that something you think that would be acceptable, even though it isn't going to be on screen 100% of the time? It would be scrolling through other messages, or would we have to have that, like, on a paper sign that's visible 100% of the time at the business office?
Well, sounds like you're pretty high tech. That is cool. I haven't heard of that. That's something that I think I would defer to the interpretive guidelines for a black and white answer. But my, better safe than sorry side of me says just post on an 8x11 sheet of paper somewhere in your lobby. If you have a board or just somewhere that you can post those. The tagline scrolling across a TV screen might work. Maybe they'll clarify that up in an interpretive guideline, but I would say just better be safe than sorry and have those posted on paper.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So next call online, on the phone. Operator?
So sorry, I was talking on mute. Our next question comes from Lindsay Bogner. Your line is open.
Hi, Lindsay. Where are you from?
Kansas.
Great.
We were under the impression, we've been working with our ESF8 group here in our county, that our community-wide exercise would involve something happening, but then we would receive patients in our clinics so that we wouldn't have to leave. Now, are we required to go somewhere else for this drill, or are we required to have the drill in our facility and actually test our own plans?
This is one that I'm not going to guess on. Again, I think this is something that will be answered by the specific community, the people who are running your community-based drill, right? So does that make sense?
Yes, but see, I'm running the community-based exercise, so
you're in charge
to set it up.
Okay. Boy, I'm sorry. I do not know the details of how to run a community-based drill, especially if you're in charge of it for the entire community. You're asking if you're going to have to shut down your clinic, or do you have to touch patients that are come in on that day?
Well, what we were understanding is that everybody stays in their facilities. We have an exercise, and the community responders take the patients to the local facilities, or, you know, in some cases, we'll wipe out one clinic. That way, everybody gets to test portions of their emergency plan, but they
sure.
have to actually do it in their own facilities rather than having them go across town to a facility that they don't know.
Right. Yeah, that seems reasonable and seems correct to me. Again, I'm not a pro on how to run a community-based drill. I just know that you have to do them. I don't know details, and I apologize for that, but I don't know the answer.
Do you know, are we going to get any more guidance on that at all?
I'm hoping that the interpretive guidelines will have that, and there may be resources already available, especially on your state website.
Okay.
That kind of further flesh out what the rules are for the community-based drill in your area. So,
okay.
I would dig around on those links that I gave you, the Ask for Tracy link, the other link that I gave you, and see if you can find your answer there. And if not, maybe it'll be in the interpretive guidelines.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. All right, so I'm going to move on to the next chat question from Yvette Martin. And she says, the system of medical documentation that preserves patient info. If an RHC does not have an EHR, what types of suggestions would make this feasible for compliance? That my suggested route, if you don't have an EHR, is, and I know it's a pain, but it's to spam your records to the cloud or to some sort of computer server that's not on site. That would preserve those records if your clinic burns down. So, like, that's kind of my standard example. If your clinic burns down or there's a tornado and goes right through your clinic, God forbid, will you have a system that preserves that patient info, right? I think the easy way to do that is to save your records electronically to the cloud. But, you know, I know that that requires a lot of administrative work. So, for those with EHRs, it's a little bit easier. For those without, it's a little bit more difficult. Again, maybe the interpretive guidelines will say if you have paper records in maybe two areas, so at your clinic and then at some other area that's away from your clinic, then maybe that would work. I would defer to the interpretive guidelines as if to something like a fireproof cabinet or some sort of really sturdy filing cabinet would also be compliant. I'll do one more from the chat from Tracy Jarl. According to Section 1557, is it a requirement to ask the patient's sexual identity? No, this is actually something that I got initially there was some confusion about. Initially, it was something that you that was one of the things that you could not discriminate based on, but then there was a court case, and it's kind of like pending right now, especially because the gender mismatches on certain HCPCS codes were causing it to deny. So they didn't really have a system. If a female patient came in or someone who identified as a female but had male anatomy and they had some sort of service that was only for males and you put female, that claim would deny. So that one gets complicated. I believe that it was put on hold pending a court case that is working its way up through the courts. So hopefully that sort of answers your question. Do we have more calls on the phone? And I think we're going to go, Joaquina, are we okay to go past 3? Maybe to 3:15?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Were you ready for your next question?
Yes.
Okay. Our next question comes from Hannah Morrissey. Your line is open.
Hi, Hannah. Where are you from?
I'm from Arkansas.
Great. How can we help?
Okay. So my question is in regards to the 15 languages and stuff. When it comes to, like, medical record request and, like HIPAA policy, confidentiality agreements, all that, are you saying that we have to have that available in all 15 languages?
And I'm going to kick this one back to you, and I'll actually hopefully I'll zoom back to it. The official word from CMS is that covered entities are in the best position to determine within reason which of your communications are significant in the context of your own health programs and activities. So that is something that you will have to do. That is a decision that you will have to make. That is the official word for CMS. So I can't offer more than what the rule is.
Okay.
Yep. All right. I'm going to do the next one on the chat. Lynn Hampson asks, regarding the community-based drills, can that be just representatives from the clinic, or does it need to be a whole clinic? Again, on the community-based drills, I'm not sure the details, so I'm just going to hopefully you'll forgive me. I'm going to take a pass on that. I think we've kind of discussed that already. Next question is from Lee Fry. Do RHCs need to have a provider and a nurse from each facility in the tabletop and full-scale exercises? I don't know about, again, this is similar to Lynn's question. I don't know about the number of staff that is expected to participate in the exercises or the tabletop exercises. I haven't seen details on that. If they are out there, I apologize, but hopefully this is something that I'll go back and research, and we can send it out over our listserv when we find out more details about the participation expected from your clinic in the exercises. Operator, do we have a call online? Phone, I'm sorry.
We do. This one comes from Shanda Spire. Your line is open.
Yes, I missed your website earlier where we would be able to download this information from. I've been able to the call but not download the slides.
Okay. Do you see in the top left there's something called file share? Do you see that on your screen?
I've not been able to see any of the presentation. I've only been able to hear the audio.
Oh, okay. Are you on the technical assistance list, sir?
I am not, but I can get added to that. How do I go back?
Yeah, if you can email me, baughn@capitalassociates.com, and that's capital spelled with an O, CAPITOL, associates.com.
Okay.
Then I can get you all set up, and I'll get you the slides and everything.
Okay.
Okay?
Thank you.
Operator, one more question on the phone.
Our next question comes from Marcy Villanueva. Your line is open.
Thank you. Hello. I had a question about the sign language, because we did have this come up in the past before this all started. We had a patient come in and had called in, and they were using the third-party calling assistance, saying that they wanted an appointment, they needed an interpreter, and that we were having to pay for that interpreter to come in. We looked around and found someone that could assist us, but it was going to be like $200 just to interpret for the one visit, and obviously that's more than what we're getting reimbursed. Is there a resource for that?
I do not think that there is funds available for that. I believe that is something that you are just expected to do as part of a non-discriminatory. It's a cost of it's a normal cost of running a rural health clinic.
I see.
Okay. But it is allowable.
Okay.
All right. So it can go on your cost report. All right. I'm going to address a few questions in the chat. Becky says, if a REC is contained in a cause organizational chart, does it need separate policies, procedures, and plans, or can they refer to the cause, policies, and procedures? Again, Becky, I'm going to refer you to subsection E of the rule I just went over. You have to have identify unique circumstances at your RHC, but you can have a similar policy. You can't have the same policies and procedures, but it has to be tailored to you have to identify kind of the unique circumstances at each facility in your larger network. So hopefully that answers your question. Paul says, you do know that there isn't a language called Chinese. It's called Mandarin. Paul, I do understand that, and I apologize if it was offensive. However, I will say that if you look at HHS's foreign language estimates, they call it Chinese. So I just wanted to be consistent for the sake, so I didn't confuse anyone. But, yes, it is Mandarin, although I do believe Cantonese is also, I don't know if that's a dialect or a separate language, but that is how it's presented in on the translated resources that I linked to earlier. Lisa says, can we get a copy of the PowerPoint faxed? Maybe. I'll look into that. Teresa asks, when was the letter sent to HHS requesting clarification on emergency preparedness, and if that will be removed as a requirement? Teresa, we sent that perhaps about a month, maybe a month and a half ago. I would not get your hopes up that that these rules will be, you know, removed for rural health clinics. We are trying. It is something that we think is overly burdensome. I think a lot of this stuff, and this is just purely my personal opinion here, a lot of these things are things that people would do during an emergency kind of by their nature. Of course, your rural health clinic is going to try to see how they can help your community during an emergency. And, you know, we have taken a position that doing all these extra, you know, burdensome drills and things like that is probably the costs are outweigh the benefits. So, but with that said, be prepared November 15, 2017. Do not bank on that, even with the executive order seemingly giving us some ammunition to justify not going forward with this. I would be prepared November 15, 2017. Okay, operator, do we have any another question on the phone?
We do not have any other questions on the phone lines at this time.
Okay, I'm going to knock out a few more questions in the chat box, and then we'll probably finish about 3:15. Marcy Villanueva asks, in regards to having RHC staff phone numbers listed, does that mean we should have the staff's personal cell numbers listed? Our staff isn't allowed to carry phones at work, so they wouldn't have them on them during work hours. However, I would still include the personal cell numbers. Doesn't hurt to have more contact information listed. So, but maybe also, however you contact your staff during the workday, you might list that out as well. Emergencies also happen in non-work hours. So if it's at the middle of the night, you having their cell phones there would also be useful. The Pinckneyville Community Hospital says that under Section 9.1.12a, for strategies to address various emergency events, we do an annual hazard vulnerability analysis, and our policy uses an all-hazard approach. Do these regs change that all-hazard approach? And we must specifically address each hazard. Yes, that sounds correct. You have to basically analyze all the hazards that could occur at your rural health clinics and analyze how you would handle each and every single one. So obviously you would handle an active shooter different than you would handle a tornado, different than you would handle a fire, different than you would handle an epidemic or a power shortage. So it sounds like you guys are doing the right thing in terms of the all-hazards approach to your emergency plan. Jan Watkins asks, how do we get a copy of, okay, sorry, I've already gone over that. Jessica says, do we have to reprint all of our forms in all 15 languages? No, the answer is no on this. So you don't have to have all of your forms in all 15 languages. You just have to have the taglines that you offer language services, just that portion translated. So hypothetically, if someone comes into your clinic and speaks a language that no one really understands, the way it would work is that you would have the form in English, and you would get your language service contractor on the phone, and then together you could walk through that form with the patient. But the form is like, it will still say name in English, and it will still have the instructions of how to fill out the form in English. It just has the tagline in the translated, in the translation. Lily Souza asks, I'm really interested in getting more information on what to post in the lobby of the RHC. Lily, this is pretty simple. Top 15 taglines. Again, I'll go over some of the examples. So what you got to do, right? So everyone who doesn't have something posted in there, in their waiting room, needs to do this immediately. Go to the link. I have it here, the very bottom, translated resources. At that link, for every single state, it will estimate the top 15 foreign languages in your state. It will also give you the exact taglines that you need to post, okay? And then you take, so then it basically looks like this. Language services are available free of charge. And you can list the phone number that people can call to get the language services. Although I believe in the FAQ, that's supposed to be your phone number. So it's pretty much your main line. It's not the line of the contractor. So it would basically be your phone number. So you would have that tagline posted in the top 15 languages. So you would get at that link, you'll get something like this, which is just for Iowa, but you'll find it for your state, and then you print out the taglines in the top 15 languages. Hopefully that makes sense. So top 15 foreign languages in your state, you have to have that tagline posted. That's what you have to have in your lobby. Jerry asks, can we get a copy of the transcription from this webinar? Yes, Jerry, we're going to post the full transcript at the link at the very end here, right here, at the bottom. So it says to view past webinars, go to HRSA.gov. So all of our webinars, including every single webinar that we've done, the transcript is posted there. Operator, do we have any calls on hold?
We do not have any at this time.
Okay, I'm gonna try to knock out a few more questions. Hopefully this is helpful. We have about 5 minutes. Hernan Serrano, those are students. He says community-based drills are primarily for the emergency response team. You do not have to send your coder to community-based drills. Okay, so Hernan apparently has done some research on it and says that not everybody in your clinic has to go to the community-based drill. Thank you for that, Hernan. Jan Watkins, again, CMS had a webinar last week, and they said that if the RHC has a different CCM number, you have to use your own emergency plan, whether or not you are in a network. I'll have to research this. I think that may be the distinction. I'm not sure what would allow you to participate in an integrated health care network if the CCN number is the thing that kind of differentiates that. So I'll have to research that. Send me an email. Karen Tidwell, our clinics are owned by the hospital. Can we be part of the emergency preparedness plan in the clinics? Yes. Again, Section E, Subsection E, 49112, Subsection E. Review that portion. Marcy Villanueva, how do we obtain a sign language interpreter? I believe there's contractors out there that will do this. I haven't done this myself, so I can't say by experience, but while it is more than your reimbursement for your all-inclusive rate, it is an allowable cost. So it can go on your cost report. Of course, if you're subject to the cap, it doesn't really help you. Or if you're over the cap and you're independent clinic or owned by a large hospital and you're subject to the cap, it doesn't really help you. But if you're uncapped, then you do get paid via a higher all-inclusive rate than next year. Kelly Harris asks, does the 15 employees count for your clinic only even if you're owned by the hospital? I'll have to research this one. My gut tells me that it is for your clinic only, but if you're part of a larger network, do you have to comply with do you have to have a point person, and do you have to have do those extra rules? I'll have to double check on that. Donna Clark, again, we have read information in the rules that this is not for all areas and that we only have to have the top three languages for our area. Nowhere is there ever a rule, at least from the federal standpoint, that there's anything top three. Now, remember, there's top 15 foreign language rules and top two foreign language rules. So for things that are small, so communications that are small, you only have to post the taglines in the top two foreign languages, okay? So, and then you also, for things that are significant but large, you have to post not only the "we offer free language services" tagline, but you also have to post the non-discrimination statement in those top two languages. So I'm not sure where that information is. If you have that information, send it to me. I'd love to see it. All right, we're going to do one. Operator, do we have any questions on the phone?
We still do not have any questions. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1.
All right, we're coming up on our limit here. This will be my last question, and if I didn't get to your question and you still want to ask, feel free to email me. My email is right there. The last question that I'll take is from Nancy Griego. If the emergency plan is with the hospital, do we need a separate plan? Again, I defer you to subsection E, 4912, 491.12, subsection E, Code of Federal Regulations. You do not have to have a separate plan, but you have to have some sort of assessment of the unique needs of your rural health plan. And it cannot just be, here's an assessment of all our rural health plan's needs. It has to be an assessment of each location's needs or unique attributes in the emergency preparedness. So that has to be built in to the larger plan, but it can be one plan. So with that, I thank everyone for participation. Apologies if I didn't get to your question. You can email me, and I'll do my best to answer. And if I don't know, I'll do my best to research and find the answer for you. And together, we will be ready come November 15th for these emergency preparedness rules, and we will get all those non-discrimination tagline questions sorted out. Thank you, everyone. I would say that concludes today's call. Actually, I have closing remarks that I need to make. We want you to encourage others who may be interested in the technical assistance series to register online. In addition, we welcome you to email us with your thoughts and suggestions for future call topics at info@nerhc.org. And be sure to put RHCTA topic in the email subject line. We do look at those emails to make sure that we're getting good topics out to you guys. And we anticipate scheduling the next RHC technical assistance call sometime in June. A notice will be sent by email to those on the technical assistance listserv with the details about that next call. Thank you for your participation, and that concludes today's call.
Thank you. That concludes today's conference. Thank you for participating. You may now disconnect.